On this edition for Saturday, July 11th, the president commutes Roger Stone's sentence. COVID-19 cases continue to surge across the country. Rethinking To Kill a Mockingbird 60 years later. And with a rise in racial crimes, a look at what is defined as terrorism in the U.S. and abroad. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. President Trump commuted the 40-month sentence of longtime friend and former campaign advisor Roger Stone last night, just days before Stone was to report to prison. Stone was found guilty of 7 felonies last November, including obstruction of justice, lying to congressional investigators, and witness tampering in special counsel Robert Mueller's probe of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Prosecutors originally recommended a 7 to 9 year sentence for Stone before the president criticized the recommendation as a horrible and very unfair situation. And leadership at the Justice Department reduced it. 4 career prosecutors resigned from the case over the move. Attorney General William Barr recently defended the reduced sentence, calling the original sentencing guidelines excessive. Stone said he is confident he will win on an appeal.
Just a few minutes ago, I had a very gracious call from the President of the United States, who told me that he had decided to use his extraordinary powers of clemency to commute my sentence, what he called a full commutation of my sentence.
Representative Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, called the commutation a, quote, attack on the rule of law.
But what we're seeing today is an appalling overture to people, essentially from the president saying, if you lie for me, you cover up for me, I will reward you.
In a statement, Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi said Congress will take up legislation, quote, to ensure that no president can pardon or commute the sentence of an individual who is engaged in a cover-up campaign to shield that president from criminal prosecution. Confirmed coronavirus infections continue to rise in most states, and deaths from the virus are now also rising. There were more than 68,000 new confirmed infections yesterday, a single-day record. That brings the total in the U.S. to nearly 3.2 million cases, according to researchers at Johns Hopkins. After months of declining coronavirus-related deaths, now they are up about 15% from 2 weeks ago using 7-day rolling averages. There were 802 deaths reported yesterday. In Georgia, where there was a record number of confirmed infections yesterday, officials in Atlanta announced the city was going back to phase 1, meaning residents are mostly encouraged to stay at home. In Texas, which had a record high number of deaths earlier this week, Republican Governor Greg Abbott predicted things would get worse and did not rule out reinstating a lockdown. And in Florida, despite spiking cases of coronavirus, the most magical place on earth is welcoming visitors today for the first time in nearly 4 months. Walt Disney World is reopening using a phased approach that limits daily attendance and requires reservations. Strict safety protocols for staff and guests include temperature checks and mandatory masks. The reopening comes as Florida announced more than 11,400 confirmed COVID infections yesterday. Using a 7-day average, that's an increase of nearly 18%. From just a week ago. Another state grappling with a sharp increase in infections is South Carolina. Yesterday, state health officials announced more than 1,700 new cases in the last 24 hours, which is more than double the number of daily cases a month ago. As cases around the state increase, mobile testing sites organized and run by local community groups have sprung up to get as many people tested as possible. Before the banner announcing COVID testing had even been set up, the cars were lined up outside Good Hope AME Church in Cope, South Carolina. Once the tents were finally up and testing supplies organized, the first person in the hot seat was the church's pastor, Reverend Georgianne Pringle. Pringle says she'd been trying to get a testing site like this to come for months to test the members of her mostly older African-American congregation, but also the general public in this rural area about 40 miles south of the state's capital, Columbia.
Oftentimes, the people in the rural areas don't have access to health care like people in the city and larger areas, and so this is a great event for us.
This pop-up COVID-19 testing site was open for 3 hours on Thursday evening and tested 137 people for free. It's part of a surge of 8 testing events this week organized by the statewide district of AME churches in South Carolina. Bishop Samuel Green leads the district.
The African-American population is very much affected because of the health disparities. And even with the numbers of cases in South Carolina in relationship to the population of African-Americans, it's disproportionate. So we wanted to, as a church, to take part in trying to help getting our people tested and hopefully to slow down the spread.
South Carolina has become a growing epicenter of COVID-19 with more than 50,000 confirmed cases. While the number of tests has increased over the last month, thanks in part to mobile testing and pop-up sites across the state, the percentage of positive tests has also been rising, an indication of growing spread. In Cope, most of the people who came to the Good Hope AME testing site were not symptomatic, but wanted to know if they were carrying the virus or not. Michelle Young waited a little over 2 hours to get tested.
Well, it was not comfortable at all, but I'm glad I did it so I could find out positive, negative.
Cora Calloway was just glad to get a test since she's heard the kits can be in short supply.
All the other places that's doing it, you have to get there very, very early, you know, to get tested because they run out.
We keep hearing that everybody can be tested, but everybody can't be tested if they do not have adequate supplies.
Green says after another church testing site he organized ran out of supplies earlier in the day, he arranged to have 2,000 more test kits sent from neighboring Georgia to have enough for this weekend. Even if small testing sites like this one are just a fraction of what the state requires, Green sees the church's efforts as a crucial part of its mission.
We in the AME Church believe in holistic ministry, and just the worship service on Sunday morning and our people are dying Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday would be really a tragedy and also an indictment upon our ministry if we did not reach out beyond the walls and minister to all people.
In Serbia, protests against the government and its announcement of new coronavirus restrictions turned violent last night. Police in Belgrade say more than 70 people were arrested after protesters threw bottles, rocks, and flares at police who were guarding the parliament building. The police responded with tear gas and said 14 officers were injured. This was the fourth night of protests that began earlier this week when Serbia's president tried to impose a weekend curfew, a plan he canceled as protests grew. Authorities then banned gatherings of more than 10 people in Belgrade and shortened the working hours of indoor businesses in an attempt to slow the spread of the virus, prompting more demonstrations. There are now more than 18,000 confirmed COVID-19 infections in Serbia, and health authorities are warning that hospitals are almost full. The coronavirus pandemic limited mourners, marking the 25th anniversary of the Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia today. After temperature checks and screenings, a much smaller than usual group came to the memorial cemetery to honor those killed and to bury the recently identified remains of 9 victims. Serbian troops executed more than 8,000 Muslim men and boys beginning on July 11, 1995, after rounding them up and separating them from women and girls over several days. International courts and the United Nations have defined the Srebrenica massacre as an act of genocide. The massacre came near the end of a war that lasted from 1992 to 1995, when Bosnians, Croats, and Serbs fought each other following the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. More than 100,000 people were killed in the conflict. For more coverage of national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. In the wake of George Floyd's killing and mass protests across the country, President Trump tweeted that he wants to designate the anti-fascist movement, or Antifa, as a terrorist organization, a designation he has not called for with right-wing extremist groups. But according to new figures from the University of Maryland's START Center, white supremacist violence in the U.S. is on the rise, with a sharp increase in deadly incidents over the last 5 years. It's part of a global trend that has led to increased scrutiny of what the United States defines as terrorism. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Simon Ostrowski has our report, which is part of our recurring series, Exploring Hate.
These men are fighters in the Russian imperial movement, armed volunteers sent to Ukraine to further their goal of creating a Russian ethno-state within Russia's historical borders. You may have never heard of the group, but it made history earlier this year by becoming the first white supremacist movement to be declared by the United States as a terrorist organization.
Since 2015, the world has seen a surge in white supremacist terrorism. Today, the State Department is designating the Russian Imperial Movement.
With white supremacist violence surging around the globe, Washington's stance on who is and isn't a terrorist has acquired renewed urgency.
The criticism of the foreign terrorist organization list was that it was predominantly Muslim groups. So it seems very symbolic, and symbols are often important, and I welcome that they are acknowledging that white supremacist violence is an international concern.
Mike German is a retired FBI special agent who worked undercover to disrupt violent white supremacists in California in the 1990s. He told NewsHour Weekend the designation of a white supremacist group set an important precedent, but worried it was being overshadowed by louder messaging from the U.S. president more recently about the protests and riots that have swept parts of the country.
I want the organizers of this terror to be on notice that you will face severe criminal penalties and lengthy sentences in jail. This includes Antifa and others who are leading instigators of this violence.
This is one of the many protests that have rocked America since the killing of George Floyd. And while this protest is peaceful, some haven't been. Donald Trump has tried to focus his anger at leftist organizations like Antifa, which he describes as terrorists. But his law enforcement agencies say America's resources should be pointing in another direction.
We elevated to the top level priority racially motivated violent extremism, so it's on the same footing in terms of our national threat banding as ISIS and homegrown violent extremism.
That was the director of the FBI speaking in February, telling Congress that his agency now considers racially motivated terrorism as big a threat as Islamist terror. Law enforcement officials are concerned by the rising number of far-right attacks that have resulted in homicides over the last several years. Figures tracked closely by the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism at the University of Maryland.
Historically, most violent far-right attacks were not mass casualty. Unfortunately, that story is changing, and in recent years, we've seen the adoption of mass casualty attacks among the violent far-right.
In fact, the university found that in the years since 9/11, the far-right has killed 201 people compared to just 140 killed by Islamists. The same time,
there are no U.S. deaths associated with any action that could be accurately described as anti-fascist.
This dichotomy has contributed to the perception that the government isn't taking the threat of white supremacist violence seriously.
This is the FBI's Baltimore field office, and I've sent them a question asking about the resources that they allocate to domestic terrorism versus international, and I'm really curious to hear what they have to say.
Sean Devereaux is the assistant special agent in charge of the field office and its counterterrorism branch.
We don't treat international terrorism any more important or any more of a threat than domestic, but there has been infrastructure in place on international terrorism for, you know, obviously a couple of decades now, and that there's just more tripwires. The other part that is on the domestic terrorism side, that's usually an American citizen who's exercising, at least in the beginning, First Amendment rights. Again, you have the right to hate, because now we have to wait until we see that there is some propensity to commit an act of violence to do with that ideology.
In international cases, you don't have to wait. And it's all because of a statute known as material support, which mostly can't be used for domestic terrorism. Under this broadly defined charge, anyone declaring support for an organization named in the Foreign Terrorist Organizations list can be prosecuted, even before attempting to perpetrate violence, which means they can be taken in long before a violent plan is hatched. This same sort of declaration is protected by the First Amendment when dealing with domestic suspects. Case in point, the story of Christopher Hassan, an officer in the U.S. Coast Guard who had planned to use this arsenal to perpetrate a mass casualty attack in furtherance of his goal of creating a white ethnostate within the United States.
Mr. Hassan was a former Marine. He was a current officer in the U.S. Coast Guard. He was an individual that had tactical training, proficient in the use of firearms, proficient in the use of deadly force.
Hassan had amassed a stockpile of registered weapons and carefully studied the manifesto of Norwegian mass murderer Anders Breivik. He'd even written down a detailed plan for his own attack. But that, on its own, wasn't enough for authorities to bring him in.
There's indication that he's going to mobilize. We have to have him in our sights, because at the time, the only criminal federal violation that we have seen from him that we could possibly take him off the battlefield is tramadol purchases, right? That's certainly it's a Schedule 4 narcotic. It's a federal felony, right? But it's a drug offense, mm-hmm. right? It's not an attempted act of violence.
Fearful he was about to go on a killing spree, the FBI went ahead with the arrest on the drug charge and then subsequently found plenty of evidence to convince a court that Hassan was indeed planning a terror attack. The Coast Guard officer was sentenced to 13 years in prison. But the case doesn't just illustrate why it's harder to stop domestic terrorists than so-called international ones.
Yeah, I was thinking about just burning the hills because there's a lot of trees and a lot of homes over there.
Take the case of Amr Sinan al-Hagagi, a California-born 23-year-old of Yemeni descent who the FBI arrested in 2016.
It was discovered that he had opened 7 Facebook and Twitter accounts for people he believed to be members of ISIS.
Daria Weissman teaches statistics at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice and collects sentencing data.
So for opening the Facebook and Twitter accounts, he was charged with material support, and then he was also charged with identity fraud, and he received a 16-year sentence. So when you compare that to someone like Hassan, it's really glaring.
His declarations of support for ISIS, a group named on the Foreign Terrorist Organizations list, made it possible to categorize this American citizen as an international terrorist and to charge him under the statute. No such list exists for domestic terrorism, prompting some to call for the creation of a domestic terrorism law to even the odds of arrest by banning groups like the KKK or neo-Nazis. But according to Weissman, that would open the door to banning movements like Black Lives Matter or Antifa, which the president has said he would like to do.
It's already a really bad idea. Like, if you create a law that's as broad as in domestic situation is material support, then it's going to be back into like the way that they prosecuted communists for, you know, guilt by association. It's going to be like a legally sanctioned police state.
So how does the government strike a balance where it can avoid looking soft on white supremacists while still protecting us from both jihadists and right-wing extremists? According to Mike German, the former FBI agent, law enforcement should make its focus violent intent for both kinds of terror rather than association with banned groups.
And that's why it's very important that the enforcement is done in a completely transparent way, so it can reassure society that a rule of law does exist that applies to everyone.
That means less reliance on lists like the one that the Russian Imperial Movement was added to, and more traditional police work, no matter what a violent perpetrator's ideology may be.
Today marks the 60th anniversary of the publication of To Kill a Mockingbird. It's required reading in many schools. Author Harper Lee's book about racial injustice set in Alabama focuses on Atticus Finch, a white lawyer in the Jim Crow South defending a black man falsely accused of rape. It was turned into a popular film and more recently, before the COVID-19 shutdown, a sold-out Broadway play. But while it's earned praise as a portrait of moral courage, it has more recently come under scrutiny for how it frames racism and its black characters. I recently spoke with Lisa Lucas, executive director of the National Book Foundation, about reevaluating the book in the age of Black Lives Matter.
I think To Kill a Mockingbird is one book. right? But I think that what ends up happening is it's the most read book, right, by middle schoolers and high schoolers. It's something that we look at as like a cultural touchstone when we think about how to parse what's happening in the American South or in the American North, and race relations in general. And I think that we've always held Atticus Bishop to be this moral guide. This is how you are a moral white person in America. This is how you stand up, sometimes alone, against injustice and make a difference. But where it stops short for me is looking really at the systemic injustice, right? Like, one person can't change the judicial system. One person can't change the hearts and minds of every single person in the nation, right? And so when we look at this one really narrow framework of how to explore one man's desire to do good, one child's, you know, sort of moral education, and then we try to apply it writ large to an entire society, I mean, I think that we find in this extremely critical moment of reckoning that it falls a bit short.
There's also this white savior complex that I think more people are open to possibly seeing now, where, you know, we have an education system where the bulk of public school students in the country are students of color and the bulk of teachers are white. And, you know, who's assigning the story? What are the identities of the children that are in the classroom and how they're absorbing it? Do they see themselves in these characters? I mean, it's a lot of complicated questions for how to rethink a text that has become, as you said, the most read thing in middle school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important what the canon looks like and who the canon builders are, right? You have publishers, authors, you know, award makers, teachers, parents that all collaborate to kind of say, this is something that we want all of our children to collectively read. But I wonder if you were to ask African-American people in America if the book that they want all of their children to read is To Kill a Mockingbird. And so it's not so much that I take total issue with the book. It's a fun book to read. It's smart, and it does have a very strong moral core in many ways, but it doesn't tell the whole story. I think what I have always wanted in literature is more stories that show Black people in full relief. You know, I don't want to look at one-dimensional Black characters in a book exploring race relations and then see every thought and feeling that the white characters have. And so where's the balance? I think that we have to revisit each of the things that we've loved and not necessarily throw them out, but to actually look at all of them and say, what do they mean together? What do they mean now? What do they mean to us in 2010 or 2001? And what do they mean in 2020?
If you were talking to middle school teachers today, what would you say, pair that book along with X, Y, or Z to try to challenge your students?
Yeah, I mean, Jason Reynolds, for instance, he wrote a middle grade book called The Track Series. It's a series of four books about a young people on a team. I'd love to see that kind of loving representation of Black life in America with all of its attendant challenges to showcase that you're dealing with people. We can't keep looking at everybody as tropes. And so I think that anything that actually shows us as we are in all the different ways that we exist in the United States is important complement to something like To Kill a Mockingbird.
And I wonder who's writing the next To Kill a Mockingbird in the context of today. You know,
I think there's so much happening. I mean, it's like publishing is really exciting right now. I mean, I think that you see, you know, a real critical lens being turned to the publishing apparatus in this moment, you know, fast, because we're creating the culture. You know, it's like we always talk, you know, people don't buy books, people don't read, except that books inform our television, our film, you know, our journalists. You know, everybody is the thought that books drive into the world are powered forward by so many other media makers and cultural thinkers. And so I just think it's really exciting that people are actually going to that foundation and saying, we have to change not only who is telling stories, but who is editing those stories. How are we publishing those stories? Who are those stories for? And I think that you will see, finally, to scale, you know, some incredible balance in letters so that we can actually see, you know, the real world we live in and not just a parcel of it.
Lisa Lucas, Executive Director of the National Book Foundation, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.